good afternoon to you all. Let's begin this debate on the creation of the Parliamentary Network on Diaspora Policies. And let's begin with the first session, which is on relations with countries of origin. We're going to begin with democratic participation of the diasporas. First and foremost, allow me to thank all of those present here today, all of those who will be speaking. And let me also thank Edward Cabrita for being here. He is Minister in the Cabinet of the Prime Minister of Portugal. We will also be hearing from Ms. Yochenko and Mr. Kuchukan, who will be the other two keynote speakers. It is an honor to participate in this conference launching the Parliamentary Network on Diaspora Policies. This is something that I have been following closely within the Council of Europe, but more specifically in this House of Parliament, the Assembly of the Portuguese Republic. I am an MP elected by Portuguese citizens living abroad. I also represent the Portuguese communities in the Ministry for Foreign Affairs. This issue of the diasporas is ever more important in a globalized world where people move around more and more. This new reality, an important one, requires us to understand that the principle of mobility is at play, and we are all becoming countries that are splintered around the world. Our citizens live in many different places, and we should recognize them in the political arena, both in their countries of origin and in their host countries. Their political participation, their participation in host societies, is extremely important. This is something we've debated in many different institutions. We in Portugal take this seriously. Since democracy became reality in the 70s, we've created conditions for expats to participate politically in Portuguese bodies in this country. So it's very important to hold a conference such as this in Portugal, in this parliament, where for many decades MPs have represented that other Portugal that is spread out throughout the world. In our country, in Portugal, residents living abroad can participate in presidential elections, in legislative elections. They elect four MPs there, and in European elections. They can't vote in local or municipal elections, but they can stand for election in these elections. Also in the 80s, we set up an advisory board in the government, similar to the French board. It's the board of Portuguese communities abroad. It's non-deliberative, and it focuses on policies affecting the Portuguese abroad. Very recently, in this very house, we approved proposals allowing these Portuguese citizens residing abroad to be part and parcel of bodies that define our policies, such as the Education Council, such as the Economic and Social Council, and also the Opinion Council for our Portuguese radio and television. So they have a voice there. And it is also important to say that Portugal is known for allowing political participation of foreigners in its territory, but I'm sure Minister Eduardo Cabrita, who has great knowledge of this, and because he holds political office, will be able to give you more details on that. This conference meeting in Lisbon brings together people from important fields. And I would now just say a few words in French. I'd like to thank Mr. Houpier, who said some very kind words about me when he spoke this morning. Allow me to say that we can have policies, but we need politicians who understand the importance of these measures for the foreigners living in our countries and for our citizens living abroad. He has done great work in his town, and I think it's a great example of how in a city where different communities cohabit, we can all work together to make everybody feel welcome, and back into Portuguese. So the challenge is to guarantee political participation. We want people to vote, to exercise the right to vote, so that they feel that they have a sense of belonging to this country too. But we also want our foreigners, our citizens living abroad, to feel integrated into their host societies. We have speakers today who know a lot about these matters, so allow me to, without further ado, give the floor to someone who has great experience on these matters, Mr. Talib Kuchukan. I apologize if I am not able to pronounce your name correctly, because it is a Turkish surname. He is chairperson of the Turkish delegation to the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. He has a master's from the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. He did his PhD on ethnic relations at Warwick University, and between 1997 and 1998, he did research in the Ethnic Relations Center at the University of Marmara, where he is now a professor. Until 2014, he was a member of the Inside Turkey magazine. He was head of the Research Institute on the Middle East at the same university, Marmara University. He's a specialist in this field. He knows a lot about the Middle East, the relations between Turkey and the EU. He knows a lot about transnational migrations, religious freedom, and specifically Muslim minorities in Europe. So I would give the floor to Mr. Kuchukan. If you would like to stand up, please go ahead and do so. The lectern awaits.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you very much for your very nice words for me. First of all, I would like to thank our Portuguese hosts and our colleagues here in this parliament for giving us opportunity to meet together on a very important subject that we have been discussing since morning. And I also would like to thank organizers of the conference to invite me as head of Turkish delegation to share my views on the political participation of immigrants in Europe and elsewhere. Actually, when I received this invitation, I was happy to accept it for several reasons. One reason is my personal interest, because I studied migration, I studied Turks in Europe and political participation of Muslims, etc. This is one case. Throughout my academic career, I have written on this subject. Secondly, my country. Turkey has been a sending country in the 1960s. Today, we have more than 6 million Turkish diaspora, mostly in Europe, but elsewhere as well. Therefore, any issue related to diaspora studies is very relevant to Turkey. In the Council of Europe, in the European Union, in the OSCE, in NATO and elsewhere, Turkey is taking this issue very seriously. Now, of course, although it was not mentioned in the morning, Turkey is also a hosting country. Today, Turkey hosts the largest number of refugees in the world. Almost 3 million refugees, mostly coming from Syria, are now being hosted in Turkey, and that, of course, brings a lot of challenges, a lot of discussions and debates that we have to share, because the issues around migration and refugees cannot be confined to one nation state. We have seen this experience throughout the ages and years, that if a number of people are uprooted, they come to one country and then they go to other countries. We have seen this huge crisis, how it has influenced Europe in the last few years. I will also share some information about the Syrian case, but it will be at the end of my talk. It was introduced in the morning by excellent speakers that the migration is a global phenomenon, and it is really changing cultural, demographic, and economic structures and demographic structures of many societies today. Although there is a rise in the populism, protectionism, especially in the recent years, but we also see the rise in human movements. The capital is moving, human beings are moving, and goods are moving. So we are living in such a world that is very much connected with each other. That's why we call it now, we are living in a globalized world or in a transnational world. And I think this trend will continue. No matter how we try to protect our borders, no matter how we try to prevent migration here and there, it will continue as we can see. It was mentioned, I think, by William in the morning that in 9 countries, maybe more, there are some disputes, crises, etc. Now the unfolding one is in Myanmar today. More than 120,000 people fled the country, and there are more than 1 million Muslims in this country. And how we are going to address this issue? I think under this roof, with such an excellent number of people, that we should address those issues. What I would like to do in this paper is twofold. One is the political participation of immigrants or members of diaspora in the local politics of the receiving countries or the host countries. Because most of those people are naturalized, they became citizens. Of course, they have the right for political representation and participation. The second level is the political participation of diaspora communities in the politics of sending countries, which enable and encourage their participation in national elections and referendums. While elaborating the context and implications of the political participation of diasporic communities on the second level, I will also try to address the impact of transnational networks on the diaspora. In the morning, we have heard about the cases of the Syrians, case of the Palestinians, and others, that we are living in a transnational world, and all the networks are alive. And whatever is happening in Israel, Middle East, or Ukraine, or Poland, or somewhere else, there is a resonance that is felt in other parts of Europe as well. And also in the morning, it was rightly said that the issues concerned with migration is a toxic one. So we need to reconceptualize these issues, because if we do not desecuritize the issue of migration, we will not be able to address this rationally. And if we cannot address the migration issue rationally, I don't think we can come with some concrete proposals that we can agree on. If we look at it emotionally, if we look at it sentimentally, and if you look at only from the position of one nation state's interests, I don't think we can take important steps in the area of migration. I, of course, argue this is something I think all of us will agree, that the political participation is a fundamental right of being a citizen. Citizenship is acquired through different means. You are born and brought up in a country, you can become a citizen, or you are born to a family or a nationality, you are an ethnicity. These are different forms of citizenship. But every citizen, whether it is in the East or in the West, whether it is in the developed countries or whether in the developing countries, they have certain rights. These are the fundamental rights and universal rights. It's been enshrined in all the documents. Right to live, right to work, right to travel, right to have fair trial, right to have property, right to have freedom of religion and conscience and expression. And I think one important right is political participation and political representation. Everybody has the right to be involved in politics in different levels. If we look at from this perspective, what we see in Europe is that, especially in many members of the European countries, we see that there has been very established diaspora communities here, coming from Eastern Europe, coming from Greece in the past, from Italy, from maybe Spain in many other European countries, and also from my country, from Turkey. As I said, more than 5 million Turkish diaspora now are living in many parts of Europe, maybe not in Portuguese, maybe not in this part of Europe, but especially in Germany, in Holland, and in France. These are the countries where mostly Turks are living. When I look at the picture of political participation of Turks in local politics, there is a promising development. Especially young generation, now they are the third or fourth generation of people. They get better education, they know the language, they know the system, and now and the political atmosphere is, let's say, more welcoming for their participation in politics. In local elections, I see that they are much more motivated. And in local councils, there is an increasing number of people from immigrant origin, not necessarily from, of course, Turkey, from Morocco, from Algeria, from other, immigrant populations. We see that there is a really important development in terms of political participation in local politics. This is something welcoming. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, it was not unthinkable. You cannot think of anybody who would be encouraged at least by the system or who would have the self-confidence of becoming a candidate because this was a different concept. But today, as I argue, there is a new generation of people who know how to claim their rights. I think this is one of the ways of empowering the immigrants. If you teach them, if you train them, if you give them this sense of, confidence, then they will be able to claim their rights. And I think the most important way of claiming your right is political participation and political representation, not only just going in voting, but also becoming a member of the parliament, member of the senate, member of the different bodies that are really making an impact on decision-making processes. I think this is what has happened in the last maybe 10 years. There is more and more people from immigrant origin that they are now taking part in local politics. But when it comes to the national politics of the receiving countries or the host countries, I don't think I can say the same thing in such a comfortable way. Because still there are many hurdles and obstacles just before the political participation of many young people. Yes, there is now representation in national parliaments. If you go to UK, if you go to, for example, France, in the last elections, I know that many people from immigrant origin now, compared to a few years ago, there is a better representation. But this is not enough. Because when you look at the people from immigrant origins, in France, for example, maybe 20% of the population are from immigrants. 20% of the population. But when you look at the representation in politics, what is the percentage? Very little. And I think that goes for Germany, that goes for other European countries. So there is no really equality between the percentage of people and the percentage of representation. That means still we have to make some ways, find some mechanisms to encourage people from immigrant origins to be represented in the national parliaments, in the decision-making bodies. Of course, in that sense, I would welcome new developments. These are also, which makes us more positive and looking forward for more developments. There are some young people, and we have seen some people here, that they are coming from different NGOs. What we see is that immigrants, NGOs, are really becoming very influential and mainstream organizations. And this is a, positive development that we have to take note of. And I think if we put those things together, better political representation and also better, organization of immigrants and I think we can move forward much more faster than we are. Now, if you look at, of course, countries and the lists, whether this political representation is taking place in the right manner, there are variations. In some countries, you have got this multiculturalist ideas. In some countries, you've got more, integrationist policies. I think these policies make an impact on the way in which people see themselves in a political environment and how they relate to the larger society. I think political participation is a key issue when it comes to integration, when it comes to a sense of belonging to a nation state and a community. Therefore, it is not a theoretical issue that we should address. I think it is a core issue if you want to see integration, if you want to see representation and political participation. So this is the case with the participation of, immigrants in local politics. It varies from one country to another, but in local politics, there is a promising development. But I think in the national elections, in the national, on the national level, still there must be some steps to encourage people, especially from the young generation, from the women, from the less represented, I think, groups, to become part of the mainstream politics. Otherwise, they will be kept out of the main decision-making bodies. That is the parliament. People make their, I think, choices, and they decide about their future through the parliaments, through the elections, through taking part in those processes. Now, the second part of my presentation is about the election processes in the sending countries. Now, we talked about a great number of diasporas, and those diasporas, because of globalization, because of media, because of transnational networks, they are connected with their own countries. Maybe the second, third, or fourth generations, they might have some identity problems. They may not be able to relate to sending countries. But what we see today, that someone coming from Algeria, someone coming from Morocco, someone coming from India, Pakistan, they have always some kind of affinity with their own countries. If they are able to vote for the elections, they do it. And that happens with many countries. I have a list in my paper. For example, in presidential elections, diaspora members from 64 countries can participate in their home country presidential elections. And that is taking place. In legislative elections, even more members in 90 countries can vote. That means there are mechanisms now people can vote. That also strengthens the relations between the diaspora committees and the sending countries. And in the morning, it was rightly suggested and recommended that sending countries should be around the table as well, not only the receiving countries. Because we cannot separate those things anymore. Diaspora, sending countries, and receiving countries, they are all interrelated, especially at a time where this communication is much easier now. If you look at the social media, you can see that relations is taking deeper and deeper roots. If you look at the satellites, if you look at this popular culture, you will see this. So there are other ways of taking part in politics of the sending countries. Voting by proxy, voting by post, voting at the customs. There are many areas of becoming part of the politics in the sending countries. Sometimes this is criticized. You know, if someone is living in London or in Paris or in Berlin, why should they vote for the politics in their sending countries? But as I said, if they are citizens of the sending countries still, it is their right. And I think we should allow them, or we should facilitate that this right should be exercised properly. And of course, if there's a political participation in the diaspora, in the home countries, there are some other issues that we have to address. Propaganda, the right to assembly, the right to have political meetings in the heart of Berlin, in the heart of Paris, in the heart of London or elsewhere, that they can talk about politics in their home countries. So there are problems with this issue. In the last elections, this is one issue that I should bring, I think, to your attention. Then I'll cut it off. On the 16th of April this year, there was a referendum in Turkey. And the Turkish politicians and the Turkish diaspora in Europe wanted to meet together to have an informed decision, to make an informed decision about the future of Turkish constitution. But unfortunately, I do not want to name and shame the countries because this is not the place, but some European countries did not allow Turkish politicians and members of the Turkish diaspora come together to discuss these constitutional changes. Turkish ministers were prevented from meeting their own citizens. And the right to assembly, right to have a political meeting or rally, were really violated by some European countries. They are all members of the Council of Europe. This is an unfortunate thing, and we have to address this openly. And I think we should really lift the barriers of political participation, whether it's in the home country, whether it's in the host country, because the political participation is a key to become a proper citizen with full rights. I will finish with some recommendations. What should be the future? I think that may be that may be taken into the declaration. First of all, I think it was rightly mentioned in morning, We have to provide an alternative narrative about diaspora, more positive, more welcoming. And we have to desecuritize the immigration issue, because when a bomb explodes in London, in Madrid last time, everybody blames a community. I think we should differentiate the community, religion, and the individual person who committed the crime. We have to differentiate all those things. And also, we have to look at some populist discriminatory laws and the media discourse. Otherwise, we will not be able to really include or to have an inclusive policy of immigrants. And we need to also address dual citizenship. Dual citizenship is an instrument that we should look at to facilitate political participation of immigrants. And, of course, we have to have more investment in creating inclusive societies through education, through dialogue, through training, through education, and also through involving the sending country around the table. And, of course, we have to have a better and more effective fight with racism, discrimination, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, alienation of young people, especially of the youth, who found it more difficult to relate to the larger society, especially in recent years. And of course, it is the beginning that we need to have a closer cooperation with the NGOs, civil society, universities, think tanks, etc. I think we have just started it here. With those recommendations, I would like to finish, but I will say only one thing about the Syrians in Turkey. Turkey now is hosting 3 million refugees, 2.9 million from Syria, the rest from Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And it has implications for Turkish politics, domestic politics and international politics. And it has a cost, social, cultural, political cost as well. We have been doing very good until now, but there are some challenges ahead. Turkey spent $25 billion on its own. And we had an agreement with the European Union, but unfortunately, less than, I think, 500 million euro came to Turkey. And Turkey is shouldering this on its own today, but there are many challenges. Today, there are 600,000 children at the age of schooling in Turkey from Syrian origin. And only 200,000 can go to school. But from this year on, the government decided that all of them must register with the school. But we have got some problems with the infrastructure of the schools. More than 200,000 Syrian kids were born in Turkey. 200,000 were born in Turkey. Of course, we are proud of having them in Turkey. But I think if we do not cooperate on issues, if we leave one country on its own, I think this will have implications for the whole world, not only for one country. Thank you. And thank you very much for your patience, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Muito obrigado pela sua intervenção.
Thank you very much for your very interesting presentation. I'm sorry to have cut you short, but we are limited in terms of time, and we do need to have a debate open to all after the speakers. I now give the floor to Ms. Katerina Yatchenko. She was married to the third president of the Ukraine between 2005-2010. She's chairperson of the Supervisory Board, the Ukraine 3000 International Foundation. They focus on health, history of art. She is a professor at a university in the Ukraine. She teaches social responsibility for companies and has worked in the field of international development. She's a member of Ukrainian immigrants who went to Chicago after the Second World War. She was in charge of the U.S.-Ukraine Foundation. She co-financed it to help develop democratic regime and the market economy in the new sovereign state. You have the floor.
Your Excellencies, Members of Parliament, ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor to participate in this important forum intended to create a parliamentary network on diaspora policy. It's also a great pleasure to be here in beautiful Lisbon, which I last visited in 2008 on a state visit with my husband when he was president of Ukraine. At that time, we were especially impressed by the very positive and progressive policies of Portugal toward our diaspora here. We want to thank the Portuguese government and parliament for the warm welcome you have shown our fellow citizens, who have subsequently formed a very vibrant community here in Portugal. Having worked on Ukrainian diaspora issues my entire life, the first half abroad, the second half in Ukraine itself, I see this initiative, today's initiative, as an excellent way to help diaspora communities play a more vital and positive role, both in their home countries and in their host countries. The parliamentary network will foster more effective dialogue, cooperation, and coordination, and help the various diaspora communities build bridges between countries and learn from each other's experiences. I laud this initiative and am certain that the Ukrainian diaspora and its organizations around Europe will play an active and constructive role. My personal experience has, to some extent, mirrored the life of the Ukrainian diaspora. My parents, born soon after the establishment of Soviet Ukraine, were forcibly constricted as slave labor to Germany in 1941, and then in the 1950s became a part of the third wave of Ukrainian emigrants to the United States. The post-war Ukrainian immigrants built on the infrastructures created by the first two immigrations at the turn of the 20th century and in the 1920s, establishing churches, schools, youth groups, credit unions, and other institutions in their host countries. They raised money and created a research institute at Harvard University. They brought up their children to feel both a sentimental attachment to their motherland and a political responsibility to inform the world about its plight as a Soviet captive nation. Our communities in the U.S., Great Britain, Canada, France, Australia, and other countries worked extensively to preserve the Ukrainian language, culture, traditions, and to tell the mass media and governments of our host countries about human rights abuses in Ukraine and the striving of our country for national independence. The multiculturalism policy of Canada, proposed by a senator who came from the Ukrainian diaspora, helped Ukrainians and other ethnic groups in Canada to preserve their identity and to prosper. And until today, it is a model for state policy to encourage diversity and tolerance. In those days, direct interaction with Ukraine was minimal during the Soviet period. Our family sent packages to families left behind, but the Soviet Union exacted very high tariffs on these packages. I personally attended Ukrainian church, Ukrainian school, youth group, dance classes in Chicago, and received a loan from a Ukrainian credit union so I could attend university. In the early 80s, my first job after university was as the director of the Washington Office of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, the chief diaspora umbrella organization, where we tried to inform the U.S. government, Congress, and media about Ukrainian issues and the needs of the diaspora. We work closely with the World Congress of Ukrainians, as well as other ethnic diaspora groups, particularly from Eastern Europe. In 1988, I worked at the Reagan White House as one of the directors of liaison to ethnic groups, where we tried to build a bridge between ethnic organizations and the presidential administration. After six attempts to gain its independence during the 20th century, Ukraine finally achieved its goal in 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Then the role of the diaspora turned from one of preserving the culture and language and informing the international community to one of democracy and institution building. Over the first two decades of Ukraine's existence, Ukrainian diasporas throughout the world lobbied host governments to provide more and better aid to Ukraine. They came to Ukraine to offer their skills and expertise in nation building, to advise the Ukrainian parliament and government on reform. They engaged in capacity building to help create or grow social, humanitarian, education, and cultural organizations. They served as election observers during Ukraine's disputed elections. As Ukrainians began to emigrate to find work abroad, many of the old organizations were renewed with new talent and ideas, and the schools and churches filled up again. I, along with many other members of the diaspora, moved to Ukraine even before the Moscow coup in 1991. I helped co-found the U.S.-Ukraine Foundation, which assisted the new democratic members of parliament with translations of international news, of many laws. We organized study tours around the world on issues such as running a government, agriculture, defense conversion, banking. Later, the foundation created programs to promote municipal development and municipal exchanges, helping Ukrainian towns and cities to deal with such issues as management, budget, environment, education, and health. I then also worked with something called Help Us Help the Children, which provided millions of dollars in humanitarian and educational aid to Ukrainian orphans, but also attempted to address the systemic problems in Ukraine's orphanage system. Other examples of effective diaspora organizations in the first two decades of Ukraine's independence included the Children of Chernobyl Fund, which raised tens of millions of dollars to help Ukrainian children and hospitals. There was also fundraising for new state-of-the-art colleges in Ukraine, such as the Kyiv Mohyla Academy and the Ukrainian Catholic University. In fact, the rector of the Ukrainian Catholic University for many years was from the Ukrainian diaspora, a PhD from Harvard. When my husband became president of our country, with assistance from Ukraine and abroad, we created the Ukraine 3000 Foundation to help Ukrainians solve pressing social issues from the bottom up, involving citizens in the development of systemic ways to improve health, education, and the arts. In 2013, the people of Ukraine came to the streets to demand their right to be a part of Europe and to protest corruption. They were supported by the Ukrainian diaspora throughout Europe and other countries, who engaged in mass protests and consciousness raising in support of Ukraine throughout the world, especially after the Russian annexation of a large part of our country, Crimea, and the invasion of our eastern lands. The Euromaidan ignited a unique wave of activism around the world. This new era was characterized by a number of important factors. First, generational. As new young people not burdened by a Soviet legacy, who were highly educated, who spoke foreign languages, who were globally integrated and results-oriented, came to important positions in Ukraine and in the diaspora. Sometimes they found resistance in old diaspora structures, but then they just created their own new organizations. They were facilitated in this by a second factor, which is the vast access to new technology, social media, communications, and cheaper transportation. Third, the war and upheaval in our country, which also caused massive inflation in the currency, led to a huge internal and external displacement of people. We are currently incorporating 1.7 million IDPs in our country as a result of our war. Many of those who went abroad were successful business people and academics who left for other countries not only for better salaries, but for the opportunity to realize themselves professionally and to play a greater role in supporting Ukraine from abroad. As a result, over the past several years, Ukraine has seen a new, more active diaspora, which is increasingly playing an important role in our country. There is, of course, the issue of remittances. In 2016, they amounted to $5.4 billion, which is almost 6% of our GDP. But our diaspora can provide not only financial, but also human, social, and diaspora capital. Some of the ways the diaspora was effective since 2014 includes lobbying for sanctions against Russia for violating our territorial integrity, lobbying for a free trade agreement with Canada. Two members of the Ukrainian diaspora went into high positions of government, one as Minister of Finance, one as Minister of Health. This is a practice that was common in countries like the Baltic countries and Georgia, but which was new for Ukraine. The Ukrainian diaspora raised large amounts of funds to help and treat and rehabilitate our soldiers, assist our displaced, and support our war orphans. With U.S. funds, several effective members of the diaspora initiated important projects to fight corruption and support economic growth in Ukraine by creating first something called Prozoro, an online system to ensure transparency in government purchasing, social enterprise financing, where $4 million is being lent to sustainable new social enterprises, to a leadership academy which trains 100 new graduates every year. An organization called Go Global is fanning English language teachers throughout the country. Diaspora provided funding to influential think tanks such as the Atlantic Council so that experts can provide more in-depth analyses of events in Ukraine and fight disinformation and fake news about our country. A new concept in our country is something called Connect Ukraine, completely designed and run by young Ukrainians in the diaspora. And in Ukraine, experts from places like Norway, Ireland, Silicon Valley, have come together for a forum, a hackathon, and workshops that bring together young social entrepreneurs, visionary innovators, creative technologists, artists, ethical hackers, to brainstorm ideas and create projects and then help find financing for them. A member of the Ukrainian diaspora in France created something called Global Ukraine, an online platform to link Ukrainians in currently 70 countries of various professions, education, business, technology, to facilitate coordination by sharing information on assistance efforts, promote Ukrainian brands abroad, provide job opportunities for Ukrainians both in the diaspora and in Ukraine. Ukraine, like many other countries that have experienced economic and political troubles that have caused massive emigration, greatly needs to harness even more the potential of our millions of diaspora abroad. Some people say up to 20 million. Many of them talented professionals with knowledge in areas important to our country. We need to encourage a brain exchange instead of a brain drain. We need to harness their best practices, unique expertise, insights, experience, and personal commitment to their homeland and families. Ukraine needs to link our skilled diaspora to national economic development priorities in business, entrepreneurship, education, fighting corruption, integrating our internally displaced, and solving social problems. We are greatly aided in this effort by the new low-cost technologies that I mentioned before, communication, transportation, which make distances less relevant and mobilization of human resources much simpler. Geography is no longer the key to identity that it used to be. Our government and parliament need to leverage the resources, not only financial but also human capital, to build startup and technology hubs, business incubators, engage in direct and portfolio investments, facilitate technology transfer, and enrich market access, help create more jobs through outsourcing. We also need to reform our educational system, both in schools and universities, so that our students are better prepared for the challenges of the 21st century. Replacing Soviet-type schools with ones that promote leadership, initiative, risk-taking, problem-solving, creativity. They need to teach every child foreign languages and coding, which is for the newer generation what typing was for mine. We also need to battle disinformation about our country internally and abroad through new websites, books, articles, op-eds, and educational materials. To achieve these goals, government and parliamentary action in our own country is essential, and the role of the Parliamentary Network on Diaspora Policies and the host governments can provide a major springboard for Ukraine and other countries. I would like to name five specific areas to accomplish what basically Director General Lucy Swing said: to engage, enable, and empower. First, to create a strategic plan to better utilize the potential of our diaspora, what they can do for Ukraine abroad through their connections and soft power, and how they can impact positively Ukraine internally, as well as contribute positively to their host country. Countries like Israel, India, Lebanon, Armenia can all serve as role models. Host governments should put more requirements for participation of diaspora representatives in their aid projects to various countries. Third, home governments need to encourage more investment by eliminating barriers to money transfers and bank accounts, providing incentives for diaspora investment in business startups and existing businesses, as well as public-private partnerships. Home governments should revise their policies on dual citizenship and relax residency requirements for members of the diaspora. And fifth, a new Diaspora Peace Corps and retired Executive Services Corps, such as the UNDP's transfer of knowledge through expat nationals, could help place diaspora professionals in regions where their expertise is needed. I look forward to our further discussion on the many ways our governments and our parliaments can work together to develop national policies on promoting diaspora's involvement in political life, democratic change, and economic growth. Thank you.
Muito obrigado.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I will give the floor to Eduardo Cabrita, who is a minister in the cabinet of the Prime Minister. He was a minister formerly. He is also an MP, so he is home. Minister, you have the floor.
Caro Presidente.
Chairman of the panel, Carlos Gonçalves, dear colleagues at this top table, MPs, members of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, ladies and gentlemen, allow me to begin by, on behalf of the Portuguese government, welcoming you all to Portugal. I hope that the work ahead will be fruitful, because this too is a priority for the Portuguese government. We want to affirm citizenship. We want integration of migrant communities in a global context. We want also for them to get to know our country better, to consider it a welcoming country, to consider it a country of tolerance, a country able to integrate and welcome peoples from different origins. Portugal, and I have to say the Parliamentary Assembly is to be congratulated for setting up this very important platform for the diasporas. Portugal is, I was saying, a singular country, exemplary in the way in which it has positioned itself vis-a-vis this topic. On the one hand, we are a country that 5 centuries ago, as many say, began what is today known as globalization. A small nation with about 1.5 million inhabitants in the 15th century, spread out all over the world to the American continent and reaching as far out as Japan. Portuguese presence in the world is part and parcel of Portuguese identity. And so our participation in this dimension is very important to us, especially when we realize that over the last few decades, during this period of democracy, we continue to see significant numbers of our fellow citizens around the world, around 5 million Portuguese people and their descendants live throughout the world on all continents. But as I'm saying, over the last few decades, our paradigm has shifted. We are now also a country which has become a destination for immigrants from many different countries. Initially, most of them came from Portuguese-speaking countries, from our former colonies in Africa, or from Brazil, the largest Portuguese-speaking country. But in the last few decades, they are also coming from other diverse places. Ukraine, for example, the Ukrainian community today is the third largest foreign community in Portugal. It is a great example, the best example of successful integration of citizens from other geographies where there was no historical tie or linguistic connection or economic links formally. And so we look to participation and citizenship, the exercising of citizenship, as something that should be widened, expanded in this global world. That will contribute to peace. That will contribute to peaceful coexistence among peoples. It will help deepen economic and positive dynamics. And that is why, and the MP, Carlos Gonçalves, already pointed to that, he, as well as 3 other colleagues, represent the Portuguese communities living abroad in this parliament. He already said that we encourage participation on the part of the Portuguese community in Portuguese political life. We want them to participate in presidential elections. They elect MPs to this parliament. They can stand for election in local elections. But we also encourage the integration of Portuguese communities in their destination countries. And that is why we feel very proud when we travel to Luxembourg, meet with the Minister of Justice, and find that he speaks Portuguese as well as we do, because he is a Luso descendant. Or we also encourage participation at the level of local and regional segments. We want more and more participation of Luso descendants in French political life. I, representing the government, recently participated in the last 2 years in a meeting that is held annually with legislators from the US who are Luso descendants. These are legislators at federal level or also at state level, where today we have a significant network of Luso descendant congressmen and women. We encourage this connection to Portugal. We encourage integration also in host countries, countries that Luso descendants see as their own today. And so we keep the ties with Portugal alive. But this also allows us to be a host country ourselves. We want to be a reference, a model throughout the world. The Prime Minister is proud of his own Indian origins. We are particularly proud when we are able to promote a warm welcome for immigrants who choose to live here. We also promote an active policy allowing them to take Portuguese nationality whenever possible, opting for dual nationality. We also promote civic participation by migrant populations. We, if you will allow me, also, and I've said this before abroad, have political debate in democracy. And political debate in democracy is often one that's controversial, there's conflict, this is part and parcel of democratic reality in politics, there's the opposition, there's the party in office. But at the end of the day, I am very proud to be able to say, and I say it here again today, but I have said it before abroad, that when we talk about welcoming immigrants, when we talk about welcoming refugees, when we talk about integration in Portuguese civic society, when we talk about this, in the Portuguese Parliament, there is no political party that is xenophobic, racist, as we often unfortunately see in other European countries. There may be many other topics where we diverge. There may be doubts that arise occasionally about this or that policy measure, but when it comes to the fundamentals, this is an area where up until the present moment, and I hope it will continue to be so, there has been no dissent. It is not an area of dissent in political debates in Portugal, as the chairman of this panel well knows. He was elected by one of the parties in the opposition. Now, given the demographic realities and challenges today, we're well aware that Portugal needs more migrants. Recently, an independent study pointed out that in order for us to maintain our populational levels, We in Portugal need an additional 50,000 migrants over the next few decades. So in order to maintain our active population levels, we will need a positive balance of 75,000 migrants per annum. In other words, Portugal realizes that migration is not a problem. Migration constitutes an opportunity, and we should prepare for it through welcoming policies. That is why when we talk about integrating refugees, we have shown openness. We have participated actively, as a report from the European Commission showed yesterday. We have welcomed refugees from Greece or Italy under the European Relocation Program. We have helped set up refugees. We have helped them settle in this country through agreements with Turkey, or thanks to our cooperation with the UNHCR. And it is because we choose to look at this topic in this manner over time that we can say that this very week an international study revealed that Portugal is the best European country for expats to live, the fifth worldwide, but the best in Europe for expats to settle. Regular studies by the OECD, for example, last year, we were said to be ranked second when it comes to welcoming immigrants. We have chosen a strategy over the last 10 years, following changes to the nationality law in 2007. We have opted for a strategy that promotes the acquisition of Portuguese nationality by citizens from other countries who choose to settle in this country and remain. Since 2007, that's about 10 years now, when these amendments came into force, the amendments to the nationality law I was referring to, we have gone from 4,000 foreigners who had acquired Portuguese nationality per year to 40,000. So it's a tenfold increase in the number of foreign citizens who annually acquire Portuguese nationality. This means, of course, that they acquire full rights. They're able to participate in civic and political spheres. Now, their political participation is also important. We have seen a significant growth in this. We've had growing numbers of foreign citizens coming to us. We saw this up until 2010, then the crisis, the economic recession took hold. We had the bailout, which led to an economic recession in the country. For a number of years, we ended up seeing fewer migrants choosing to come here. That also translated into fewer foreign citizens. In 2016, however, this stabilized, and it's not yet a positive balance, but it's neutral now in terms of growth. The economy is recovering, so the trend should probably change. We gave citizens the right to vote in local elections, citizens of the European Union, and based on reciprocity principles, 11 countries up until the present time have established reciprocity agreements allowing Portuguese citizens living in their respective countries to also participate in local elections, standing for election and or voting. Now, we felt that we should go even further when it came to political and civical participation on the part of those citizens. The Cape Verdean and Brazilian communities are the communities that most participate. They register to vote. This, of course, is optional. It's not automatic, which is in the case, which it is in the case of national citizens. And our policies aim to significantly increase the number of foreigners registering to vote in local elections. They represent about 4% of our population at the present time, but only 0.3% of voters at local election level. Now, we are having local elections 3 weeks from now. Unfortunately, the number of voters, foreign voters, is only 27,000. We'd like to see a bigger number in the future, a significantly bigger number. However, it's good to see foreign citizens become members of municipal assemblies or parish assemblies. It's good to see them participate in electoral processes as candidates. This is a sign of increased political participation. It's more than just economic participation. They helped the Portuguese economy grow thanks to their hard work, thanks to their investment. They are very active culturally in associations, associations throughout the country. We see their ties to the High Commission for Migration, but we'd also like to see greater civic participation on the part of foreign citizens. As I was saying, we already have quite a lot of registered voters. That's around 30% in the Cape Verdean community. As I said, they're the ones who most take part in elections. They register to vote in local elections. We'd like other communities to do the same. We'd like to expand reciprocity rules to other countries as well, other countries with significant numbers in this country. This is a challenge that we have incorporated in our welcoming strategy. We have gone abroad. We have a presence all over the world, and that determines the way in which we also welcome our citizens, foreign citizens, alongside them, and the way in which we grant Portuguese nationality to those who would like Portugal to become their home for many years to come. We believe that migration policy should have a long-term view. We believe it should be part and parcel of the development strategy of the country, and it should reunite as much consensus as possible. And that is why we are very pleased to have this meeting here. We are actively involved at government level, at the level of European institutions, and I am sure also, allow me to say this, to our MP chairing this session, I am sure at parliamentary level too, Portugal will continue to participate actively in policies combating xenophobia, combating discrimination against foreigners, so that we have a more democratic and integrated Europe. Thank you.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Ministro Eduardo.
Thank you very much to Minister Eduardo Cabrita. This is real. We have a common understanding in Portugal. We welcome immigrants. We are aware of all our expats throughout the world. All governments in this country have always done their best to integrate our citizens in their host societies. We also welcome those who come to us. This is just how things have always been in a country that has a history of immigration, emigration, and welcome. I'm now going to give the floor to the room. 8 people have asked for the floor to participate in this debate. We have only about 20-25 minutes for the debate, so I would ask you to restrict your comments to 2-3 minutes maximum. I'm not trying to stop you from speaking, but we do have to respect the time slots allotted to us. And so without further ado, allow me to give the floor to, I'm sorry if I get the names wrong, it's someone representing the Armenian Parliament. Armen Q, I hope I've pronounced that right. You have the floor. 2-3 minutes, please.
Thank you very much, distinguished chairperson, dear colleagues. Thank you for this opportunity. Special thanks for very valuable remarks and contribution to keynote speakers. Just a few words, few comments, because tomorrow I will have a chance to deliver another speech as a keynote speaker. So the first comment is about, I think, the axiomatic approach that there is no special democracy for diaspora. Democracy should be universal. There is no diasporal democracy. So you can't tune democracy towards any diasporal community to feed up ambitions or let them exercise their rights, because the rights should be universal and should be covered for all human beings, despite nationality. So we should be very cautious here to avoid positive discrimination as well, because the rights are universal. Democracy is, first of all, involvement, inclusiveness and participation, but it's also about the values. So the second comment is that if the country of origin is struggling for democracy for his compatriots in different countries, it would be preferable if the country of origin would be democratic itself. Impossible to strive for democracy outside your own country for your compatriots if you inside the country are not democratic. So when we speak about the freedom of expression, freedom of media, right of justice abroad our countries, it's very necessary, first of all, to keep all these freedoms and rights inside the countries. In that sense, I have been reminded a very interesting comment of the Turkish president, Mr. Erdogan, made in March to the German before his constitutional referendum. He appealed for the Turkish diaspora to have 5 kids. It's okay, I like kids very much, but you imagine that in European political elite, such kind of announcement brought up, feed up xenophobia, and this is a kind of demographic weapon. We should be very cautious in that sense also, because diaspora communities should not be covered in the hosting countries as a possible demographic weapon. And the second remark, the last remark is about upcoming German elections. I am not sure is there anybody from Germany here, but if the leader of another country calls to his compatriots not to vote in another country for Christian Democrats or Social Democrats, excuse me to say it, but this is not democracy. This is interference in the internal affairs of another country. So we should be very cautious not to break the rules of universal democracy. So I thank you very much for your speech, because it gives me a lot of feet to think and to say it loudly. Thank you very much.
Muito obrigado.
Thank you very much. I will now give the floor to a representative from the Romanian Parliament, Constantin Codrianu. I really do apologize, but only 2-3 minutes each, because we have very little time left and we'll have another opportunity later on. There will be another debate. What we want is as much political participation on the part of the diasporas as possible, because if you don't vote, you're not counted. So we would like to have as many people participate in this parliamentary network as possible. We want you to indicate how diaspora can participate in both host and countries of origin. Thank you.
Chairman, first of all, I would like to start by congratulating those who came with this idea of creating this parliamentary network on diaspora policies, because we all understand that when a state develops a diaspora policy, it affects both the home country, but also the countries that host the members of that diaspora. And it's an initiative that we all needed. And I can say, for instance, that today here I talked to my colleague from Ireland, and we will have a visit to Dublin as soon as possible. When it comes to democratic participation of diaspora, I think of the political implication and the involvement of the Romanian citizens in their host countries. Romania understood that it is very important, and as of 2008, there are six places for those who are in diaspora that are specially allocated for the Romanian citizens living abroad. And also when it comes to democratic participation of diaspora, I am a living example of this thing, because I was born in the Republic of Moldova. Now I'm representing the Romanians living abroad. We have a separate constituency for those who live abroad. And more than that, as of 2016, we have a separate ministry in the Romanian government that is in charge of the Romanians living abroad. And it is very important to understand that when we speak about the diaspora, it affects, as some speakers mentioned before, the entire continent, but not only the continent, because, for instance, Romanians, there are 10 million Romanians that represent the diaspora, and for a nation of 20 million, it's quite a lot. We have the Romanians who live in the historical communities, but also we have the Romanians who live in the economic diaspora, and the relationship between them and the home state also affects, as I've said, the hosting countries. And I do hope that the meeting today will end up, after all, from a place where we can debate and talk into a place where we can act, and we can change things for the benefit of the citizens we all represent and serve. And I will end my comment by saying that we all are grateful to the Portuguese colleagues for hosting this event in this wonderful building, especially due to the fact that we are close to a very important historic date for the Romanian-Portuguese relations. We also celebrate 100 years since the diplomatic relations between the states were established, and especially because there is a diaspora, a Romanian diaspora here in Portugal, and there are some members of the diaspora that are present in a magazine that I came across when I arrived in Lisbon, and thank you on behalf of the Romanian citizens for Portugal being such a welcoming hosting state. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your kind words, especially those for the Portuguese people. I'd now give the floor to the member of the Maltese Parliament, Mr. Kutaja. I apologize. 2 minutes, please.
My colleague, Dr. Ray Sherry, who works at the Ministry for Foreign Affairs in Malta, and he's also the president of Europeans Throughout the World, will be doing the intervention.
Yes, thank you, Honourable MP. First of all, may I make a comment this time about the historic importance of this meeting here in Lisbon. It's a landmark meeting for the simple reason that Europe, compared to other regions of the world, has lagged behind in this area. And this meeting today, I would say, marks the beginning of a very important road that we have ahead of us to look at this very important subject. Just one comment, that basically we have 10 countries from the Council of Europe who have more people abroad than in their own country. Malta is one of these countries. We are only 400,000 people, but we have 1.5 million abroad. Some of these countries have difficulties with granting democratic rights to their own people, for the simple reason that a lot of these people do not pay taxes in Malta, and obviously if an election comes over, these people will most likely determine the government in Malta, and they live thousands of kilometers away. So there are problems that we need to overcome even among ourselves in Europe. So our suggestions are as follows: that immediately following this meeting, there is a consideration that at European level, we should have a convention for Europeans living abroad to discuss these issues. And Portugal would be excellent in this area. Obviously, it's a shining example in diaspora affairs on the international stage, not only on European stage. So we commend Portugal on its efforts, on its work in this area. A second suggestion would be to create a year for European diaspora communities in Europe, so we could create the necessary conscience amongst Europeans that immigration, migration, remigration, return migration is not toxic. We need to detoxify this topic. And that's one of the reasons we can do. The final point is, at European Commission level, we should have, in the future, at the next Commission, one Commissioner for Diaspora Affairs. At the moment, diaspora issues is spread amongst three different commissioners. At European level, we should have one Commissioner on Diaspora Affairs. Thank you very much.
Muito obrigado.
Thank you very much. I will now give the floor to a member of the Bulgarian Parliament, Ladislava, Alaznova, Bulgaria, please. I would just ask you to be succinct, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. The diaspora policy has several different aspects, which makes difficult to combine them into a single guideline. The various diasporas in Europe number over 64 million people who came in Europe, size centres and still coming now, however, they are quite diverse to be dealt in a field manner. Widely speaking, it would not be a best idea. I would like to point to several aspects of this issue. First, there is the policy pursued by the King State toward in diaspora. Next, there is the policy of the host state toward the same group of people. The so-called in a number of Council of Europe documents, migrant diaspora of those newcomers who just came to European states or are here, since 2 or maximum 3 generation in the third aspect in the issue. Sometimes tension occurs between the King State and the diaspora host state. This makes it difficult to achieve true integration. An example is the debate in the Assembly on the preferential treatment of the national minorities by their King State, the case of the Hungarian Wall or 2001 of Hungarians living abroad and not interested in resolution. When we debate such issue, it would be beneficial to remember the clash between Hungary on the one side and Romania and Slovakia on the other. This is not the sole example. In a situation like that, it is of vital importance that diaspora stays loyal to the host country. Only then I could play a role, a bridge between the host and the King States. When it comes to the migrant diaspora of newcomers who have arrived recently or are continuously arriving, there are several other aspects which complicate Persian and right policy. For example, it is easier for European people coming to live from a European King State to another European host state. In general, despite their linguistic and cultural difference, they all share the same values and respect the rule of law and human rights. In such a case, they could easily integrate in their new place of residence because it is also in Europe. In contrast, when the migrants arrive from a culturally different area and are not able to integrate, then a danger arises for creation for parallel societies with different values from the European. Such parallel societies would be a subject of ostracism by the host society on the one hand, and would self-isolate from the local community of the other hand. This is potential volatile development which showed but did not evolve to happen. Thank you.
Muito obrigado.
Thank you very much. And now, the senator from Algeria, Mr. Hussala. I was invited to be there once upon a time to talk about civic participation of the diasporas, that was the countries of the south and the north. You have the floor.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to contribute to this topic, our discussion about the relations with countries of origin and most notably in democratic participation. And I seem to... one of the points, rather, that I would like to make is that, like with the technologies, it's difficult to transfer democracy from one country to another, and this is not something that can occur in many countries of origin. Many people leaving these countries leave their countries for economic reasons rather than political or more reasons or more democracy. So with regards now to the participation or rather democratic participation in a country of origin, there's this is quite a complex issue. You need to have the necessary institutional framework within the countries of origin. You need to have instruments necessary within the parliament to encourage this participation of these migrants. You need to have, which can be quite a challenge. You need also the logistical measures, some of the electronic or technological devices or mechanisms that would enable participation in the country of origin. There are also aspects relating to country host countries. There can be challenges when it comes to communication. We heard about the Turkish example where the difficult communication of with Turkish migrants settled in other countries. Also, for host countries, there can be efforts made to facilitate process of taking part in the elections, be they referenda or other legislative elections in countries of origin. So countries of host countries can also facilitate this process. So there are a number of different factors that come to play when it comes to the effect of democratic participation of diaspora and their countries of origin. In the absence of a number of different instruments or right conditions, it would be difficult for any citizen citizen from to take part. There's a loss of the sense of belonging as well in the process. And when that happens, the host country and the country of origin cannot benefit from somebody who has lost his or her identity. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I will now give the floor to the representative from the Jordanian Parliament, Mr. Al-Kazi, Hassani Al-Kazi, I believe. Jordan, the Parliament of Jordan. No, not in the room at present. Well then, Mr. Ubjic Bozo from Croatia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished colleagues. It's my pleasure to have the opportunity to share with you the Croatian experience dealing with Croatia issues, especially with the infrastructure, our state infrastructure dealing with the diaspora issues. Croats are among European people with one of the most marked and longest tradition of emigration. The first great waves of immigration began already in the 15th century due to the Ottoman threat from the southeast. The result of such immigration are the presently Croatian minorities in the European countries. The second great wave of immigration was in the 19th century, especially at the turn of the 20th century, that is overseas immigration in the America and Australia. Today, we are facing the new type of immigration, especially after Croatia joined the European Union. For economic reasons, the younger, highly educated Croats are moving principally to more developed EU countries, searching for job opportunities. We estimate that today about 3 million people in the Croatian diaspora worldwide, including the descendants. In comparison to the 4.5 million citizens of Croatia, it is relatively the biggest diaspora in the world. The oldest institution dealing with Croatian diaspora is the Croatian Heritage Foundation, which has started its work more than 65 years ago, long before the Croatia was recognized as an independent state. Average events this foundation organizes is about 60 per year. By adopting the strategy on cooperation with Croats abroad and the Act on the Relations of the Republic of Croatia with Croats abroad in 2011, the support of Croats outside of Croatia, we have established the State Office of Croatian abroad. Also, on the parliamentary level, we have established the Committee on Croats outside of the Republic of Croatia, which I am proud to preside at this parliamentary mandate, because I was elected in the quota of the 3 MPs in the Croatian Parliament reserved for Croats outside of Croatia. And let me to conclude. The migration are not automatically bad or necessarily final. Keeping good relationship between the diaspora and homeland is important for the emigrants, but also for the country of origin, and we should do our utmost to strengthen their ties. Thank you.
Muito obrigado.
Thank you very much. And so, in conclusion, the last person on the list, Mr. Kirk, I believe from Austria.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. There has been much discussion today about the possibility of integration and the respect for the migrants. These are very important issues that we all support. I would also like to point out another side of the migration, those of the people in the receiving countries. If integration will work good, it is also very important. Austria has 8 million persons, 1 million of this has a migration background in the first or the second generation. Many people are welcome in Austria, those who accept the rules and the lives of our society. That is when they learn German, if they respect women as an equivalent person, if they do not place the rules of their religion above those of our state, and much more. Unfortunately, there is a minority of immigrants, about 10 or 20%, who do not want to accept this, and they are to blame for the opinion against all migrants. We must therefore not only set a sign that we, the receiving countries, are doing everything to speed up integration, we also have to set a sign that migrants must accept the society, the way of life, and the laws of the host countries. Otherwise, the situation with regard to the bad opinion to the migrants will deteriorate rather than improve. It is fundamentally incomprehensible that someone wants to immigrate to a country whose laws he does not want to respect and whose society he does not want to accept. These people should go to other countries or stay at home. I also say we don't want to get the policy of an origin country in our country. If someone from the migrants wants this, the way to go out of our country is open. Migration, diaspora and integration have two ways, give and take, not only one.
Muito obrigado. Chegamos.
Thank you very much, and that brings us to the end of the Q&A. I apologize to those who still wanted to speak, but we've run out of time. I'm now going to give the floor back to Mr. Kuskan, and also to the minister, should they want to say a few final words. I would ask them to be as brief as possible. Ms. Yuchenko will have the opportunity to speak again on the next panel, and so she has said she won't speak now. So one final comment from you, Mr. Kusukan.
Well, thank you very much. I just would like to clarify one point. That is the context of the relationship between Turkey and some of the European countries, because my colleague from Germany made a reference to this. There was a political debate between Merkel and Schulz a few days ago on television, and half of the debate was on Turkey, actually, although they were debating the election campaign, elections that is coming in September. The relations between Germany and Turkey is deeply rooted. But when there are elections, sometimes the winds of populism is influential. Therefore, we should take the statements of these days in this context. But let me remind you the official position of Turkey and President Erdogan when it comes to the Turkish minority or Turkish citizens who are living and being part of German society today. He says, integrate into the society. And he has said this very openly. He had meetings with a large number of Turkish immigrants living and naturalized, being citizens of Germany, naturalized, become citizens, integrate, take part. But he said only one thing. I think everybody will agree. He said, do not assimilate, because that means losing your identity, losing your sense of confidence and belongingness. This is the policy of Turkey, and President Erdogan has said it on a number of times. And as I said, Turkey and Germany is partners. When you look at the economic relations between the two countries, it is very strong. And I hope that after the elections, things will become more rational. Because, as I said, during the time of elections and campaigns, instead of rationality, sentiments are becoming more influential. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister Cabrita. Thank you very much, Chair. I simply want to say how pleased I am to see this desire on the part of all parliamentarians to work together. I think we do need to widen civic participation, the social integration of migrants, of the diasporas, in the Council of Europe member states, countries that respect human rights, democratic principles, who understand that these are principles that underpin their participation. Portugal is willing, based on its experience and policy promoting participation of the Portuguese in the lives of the countries where they live, but also based on our policy which promotes welcoming policies, integration policies. We're willing, as I was saying, to promote this dialogue based on the principle that Europe needs migrants, but participative, active migrants who feel part and parcel of the societies that they have made their homes. We don't want to build new walls in Europe. That goes against the grain of European ideals. We understand countries that have also welcomed significant numbers of refugees because of the recent migration crises. We're talking about Germany, Italy, Greece, for example, Sweden even, who welcomed refugees, and they were countries of first destination or transit countries. But they came in significant numbers. Portugal is firmly committed to promoting a Europe that is welcoming and democratic. inside our country, we believe that the integration of migrant communities is beneficial to the Portuguese economy, strengthens social cohesion, and strengthens democracy, which is why we feel it is a policy objective. We should continue to pursue this welcoming strategy. We should continue to create mechanisms that will allow for rightful integration of workers, investors from foreign nations, incorporating them into our economy, but also promote greater participation. This also allows us to set up reciprocity agreements for participation in local elections, for voter registration in the context of local elections. They should be able to exercise their rights normally. We believe this to be positive. We believe that it is positive that there be in the future more non-Portuguese people arriving in this country and feeling like they can belong to communities in this country, taking on roles at civic level, at political authorities, at local level, regional level, etc. And that is why we believe this network for the diaspora should be supported, and you can count on us to remain committed creating platforms for greater dialogue.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Ministro. Chegamos ao fim deste nosso painel.
Thank you very much, Minister. We've come to the end of this session. But this double sense of belonging, being connected to one country, living in another, is wealth for both countries. It enriches both countries. The ties that link the diasporas to both nations requires civic participation, in my opinion, based on my own experience. This is also a challenge for the Council of Europe. This parliamentary network that will focus on the issues is taking its first steps. But in Portugal, we say you have to take the first few baby steps to go far. And today we take those first few steps. There will be obstacles along the way. Some will be ideological more than anything else. If we think about people, however, if we think about our peoples, our populations, I'm sure the results of our work will be positive. It has been an honor to moderate this session. We had wonderful speakers. People are very knowledgeable in this field. It's very good to have the Council of Europe linked to a cause that makes Europe a better place. Just as my population is spread out all over the world, we can have much more influence throughout the world. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope everyone has had their coffee and is ready for a continuation of our very, very interesting discussions. Right now, we will start the panel on the diaspora's impact on the development of the countries of origin. And I'd like to start with Mr. Andrea Rigoni, the chairperson of the Subcommittee on Cooperation with Non-European Countries of Origin and Transit of the Committee on Migration, Refugees, and Displaced Persons. And of the PACE, and he will be speaking on the case for a European Parliamentary Network on Diaspora Policies. And I think we all know that we are here because of his great commitment to this issue, his activism on this issue, and we're very grateful to you for that. Thank you. Okay. Our first speaker will be speaking in Spanish, so please put on your earphones. In Italian.
Sì, grazie. Io parlerò nella mia lingua.
Thank you. I'll be speaking Italian, my mother tongue. Thank you, dear President, dear Chairman, rather, and friends, ladies and gentlemen. This is an important day for myself as well as for the committee. Today is, in fact, the result of almost 20 years' work of the Parliamentary Assembly on diaspora issues, and our committee in particular has been dealing with diasporas in Europe since 1999, when a first recommendation was adopted on links between Europeans living abroad and their countries of origin. In 2004, another report on this subject was prepared, and in 2009 there was also a resolution adopted on engaging European diasporas and the need for governmental and intergovernmental responses. This report was prepared by a Ukrainian parliamentarian, Mrs. Bilozir, and in fact our moderator this afternoon is Ukrainian as well. Is Mrs. Bilozir. And so within this recommendation, the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe was invited to give further consideration to the establishment of a Council of Europeans abroad, a body representing European diasporas at the pan-European level, and which would organize a forum of Europeans abroad at regular intervals, and to do this under the auspices of the Council of Europe. And these documents, he simply underline the need for greater political participation of migrants in order to enhance their capacity to promote and transfer democratic values. The Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe also called upon its member states to draft migration policies which can promote an institutional role for diasporas. Further, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe started looking into more detailed instruments to ensure better involvement of diasporas in a renewed political debate on developing national policies that would encourage diaspora's participation in political life, as well as greater roles in democratic change in European societies. Subsequently, I myself worked on a report, so I'm here for a reason, I worked on a report entitled Democratic Participation for Migrant Diasporas, and in 2015, the Assembly adopted an important resolution, Resolution 2043, calling for the establishment of a parliamentary network for diaspora policies. So that was 2 years ago, and since then the idea has been supported by my colleague, Mr. Pierre-Yves Le Borne, in his report on education and cultural networks of communities living abroad. In the Assembly's Resolution 2124, and also by the Subcommittee on Relations with Non-European Countries of Origin and Transit of the Committee, which I have the honor to chair. So this subcommittee has considered the establishment of this network as a priority task and has organized several preparatory conferences on this topic. It's not by chance that this launching conference is in fact taking place in Portugal in March 2015. The Portuguese Parliament hosted a conference entitled North-South Migration Dialogue, where the concept of the network was first announced. So we are very grateful to the Portuguese Parliament for its consistent support, and I'd like to thank Portugal for hosting this launching conference for our network. I would like now to present the concept behind the idea of the network, as well as its main purpose and its proposed activities. As from the Italian experience, I know very well that diaspora communities represent a cultural, economic, and political bridge between the countries of residence and country of origin. In the last 20 decades, diasporas have become one of the driving forces in bringing democratic experience to their countries of origin. In particular, diaspora organizations have been very active in establishing and developing civil society in many Central and Eastern European countries. In recent years, diaspora communities have started to play a more active role in defining the policies of their countries of origin and their countries of residence. And the rapid increase in working migrants, the desire of migrants to return to their home countries at retirement, and the wish of many migrants to be to play a more active role in the political life of their host countries, as well as in the countries of origin, all represent new challenges in many policy areas. This topic has therefore become a priority issue on the international agenda. In June 2013, I was invited to represent the Assembly at the Interministerial Dialogue on Diaspora, launched by the International Organization on Migration. We heard the Director General of the IOM this morning. And this was the first global meeting gathering ministers responsible for diaspora matters. And at this conference, I had many inspiring exchanges. We parliamentarians have indeed an important role to play in shaping the policies in relation to diaspora in our countries. So at the time, I thought it would be very enriching to have a platform for the exchange of ideas and experiences on diaspora-related issues between parliamentarians and with diaspora associations as well. The proposed Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe network constitutes the next step from a broadly defined policy on institutionalized political dialogue about diasporas towards the creation of a mechanism to address concrete issues related to inclusive societies together with diasporas. And so this is the challenge ahead. That is to say, the network will mainly focus on building increasingly inclusive societies. It will focus mainly on work with members of parliaments, diaspora associations, state institutions from countries of origin and host countries of migrants, aiming at building inclusive societies and by introducing and implementing national diaspora policies. it will indeed provide a rare opportunity as well as a challenge, of course, and we are convinced that we'll be able to meet this challenge, but it's a rare opportunity, as I was saying, to bring together associations and parliamentarians from countries of origin and host countries. Diasporas have an increasing influence on economic, political, and cultural development of countries of origin. At the same time, diasporas can facilitate the process of building inclusive societies in their host countries. So the network will enable this to happen in a more structured and coordinated way. So the European Parliamentary Network on Diaspora Policies will be empowered as well to promote policies and will also encourage legislative reform with respect to diaspora's role in both society, countries of origin and host societies. And this effort should not lead to fragmentation. Rather, this should be an instrument that will bring about legislative and policy reform with respect to diasporas in both societies. And so the added value of this network will be enhanced dialogue and consultations between all stakeholders involved and to the mutual benefit of diasporas. We need to emphasize the positive impact of migration, not only the difficulties and challenges. We need to highlight the pros of migration and emphasize the way in which migration contributes to the general development of both host countries in Europe and countries of origin. And I firmly believe that this is an instrument that will provide new momentum to national parliaments, specifically in areas focused on diaspora aspects, and this will also enable diaspora associations and members to be more involved in political life in countries in which they live. Members of this network will take part in annual fora to be scheduled and conferences to be organized next year, and focusing on ways of integrating diasporas and the diaspora associations in countries of origin and host countries. Well, once again, the key stake is to maintain strong links, enabling these migrants to return back to their countries of origin. And this should also be an effort aimed at promoting dialogue and communication, bridges between countries of origin and host countries. So between these different international fora, we could also hold national meetings, so we're working with parliaments and national associations on specific topics, for instance, political participation of diasporas in Europe, introduction of policies fostering the participation of diasporas in political life, the role of diasporas in associations, and I think that working with other Council of Europe bodies, we are planning to organize two interparliamentary conferences on integration policies, with emphasis on the role of diaspora associations and the development of synergies with public authorities, and a second conference on the role of education in integrating migrants and maintaining cultural links with countries of origin through language training, in cooperation, as I said, with other Council of Europe directors. And to strengthen dialogue between members of the network, we would organize two regional seminars that would be organized, the first of which would be organized before the end of this current year. And so these regional seminars would be organized in cooperation with national parliaments and with the participation of countries of origin and diaspora associations. So a European Diaspora Prize would be awarded as well on the occasion of each annual forum to an exemplary diaspora association. And the functioning of the NACROC will be ensured by the Secretariat of the PACE Committee on Migration, Refugees and Displaced Persons, cooperation with the PACE's Committee on Culture, Science, Education, Media, in collaboration with other Council of Europe bodies, such as the North South Center, Youth Departments of the Council of Europe, and regional authorities. The main partners in the implementation of the activities of this network will be obviously the parliaments and governments of the Council of Europe member states, parliaments of non-European countries of origin and transit, and migrants diaspora associations. We would also like to collaborate with international organizations such as the IOM, the European Parliament, the General Directorate for Democracy, as well as the Congress of Local and Regional Authorities, all of which share similar values. The involvement of several foundations to support certain activities is also planned, and their contribution to economic cooperation and development and general cooperation with diaspora would be a great asset in the long term. At the end of this launching conference, we will propose the adoption of a declaration announcing the launching of the network and including a list of its members, which will then be open for new participants. We'd also like to suggest that the day of adoption of the declaration should become the European Day of Diasporas, which should thus be celebrated all over Europe in the future. Finally, I would like to close by thanking you all for your enthusiastic response and for your participation in this conference. I call on you to join the European Network on Diaspora Policies as active members. Today, the White House, which should be the best guarantor of democracy, has canceled up to 800,000 residency permits. These are young people who only know the United States as a country, who only know English, and who arrived in the United States when they were babies or very young children, and who unfortunately won't be able to stay in that country. And therefore, today in Europe, we need to. There's some voices in favor of helping these migrants go back to their home countries, but we need to be realistic. We need to be aware of the data that has been published. Some 400,000 migrants are in detention centers in Libya. These are the figures that we need to keep in mind. This is a major challenge, which shows the very dire conditions that these migrant populations live in. So I'd like to address you as Europeans who share our values. We do not only share physical traits or the color of our own skin, but what makes us European is our belief in our values and our ideals, that is to say, the same rights to all, without which there is no democracy, without no rights. And so we all deserve to be able to make the best out of our lives, and we need, therefore, to do the best we can to do so. This is the history of my country, Italy, but it's also the history of Europe as a continent. This has enabled Europe to chart its course, and this is very much the course we need to stick to. Currently, it is crucially important to stand united, to be very clear in voicing our credo and our shared values. We need to stand firm and united. We need to build more bridges within Europe, but also with other continents. And this is something that the network will contribute to. It is, in fact, the purpose of the network, which will build bridges between continent states, different societies, cultures, and ideas. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rigoni, for the passion that you have for the subject that brought us all here today. Thank you. I would now like to turn to our three keynote speakers on the topic of diaspora's impact on the development of the countries of origin. And first, it's Dr. Schmidt Brehme, and he is from Germany, studied law and philosophy, and has had a very distinguished career in both law and foreign service. He is currently the ambassador for the 2017-18 Global Forum on Migration and Development. Simultaneously, he recently became the ambassador to Morocco as well. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, first let me begin by thanking our Portuguese host.
It's always a pleasure to return to Portugal.
I stayed in English, no problem. I was posted here in Portugal. It's always nice and good to come back. Excellencies, members of the different parliaments, ladies and gentlemen, each of us holds a piece of the migration puzzle, but no one has a whole picture. It is time to start putting it together. This famous quote by Kofi Annan at the very first UN high-level dialogue on international migration and development in 2006 marked the start of the international debate and processes on migration and development. This was also the starting point of the Global Forum on Migration and Development, GFMD, which has tried since 2007 to help putting pieces together. And it is my distinguished honor and pleasure, together with my Moroccan friend, El Habib Nadir, Secretary of General of the already mentioned Ministry of Moroccans Abroad and Migration, to co-chair this GFMD in its 10th year. And you see, we choose as a symbol a bridge, bridging the Mediterranean from Morocco to Germany, from Germany to Morocco. And he asked me to convey his best wishes to this reunion here as well. You see, one important puzzle piece is the diaspora. Since its inception in 2007, GFMD has been promoting the diaspora's important role in migration and development discourse, both as social, economic, and political contributors to the development of the countries of origin, as well as important actors in migration and development process and fora. However, when working with or talking about diaspora, one has to be aware that diaspora does not exist as such, but diaspora are a very diverse and heterogeneous group as any civil society group. You see, me being posted now to Morocco made me a migrant. The family that Bill Swing gave us an hour sketch this morning, or the famous chief financial officer moving from the U.S. to Singapore or vice versa, they are migrants, but we are the migrants deluxe. We shall never forget the situation of the vulnerable migrants, the undocumented labor migrants, the exploited women, the abused children. So we always have to see who belongs to the diaspora groups. And if we praise migrants, maybe we're thinking of the high-tech engineers and not taking into consideration the plight of the poor migrants, exploited one, coming from Bangladesh, from India, from Pakistan. Diaspora engagement B has large potentials for development benefits for the countries of origin and destination alike. Thus, out of the recommendations formulated during the GFMD summit in Berlin this June was to include migration into national development plans, poverty reduction strategies, national adaptation plans of action, and sectoral development planning, and to strengthen the dialogue with the diaspora on the development issues. Therefore, German Development Cooperation considers diaspora, both organized in associations as individuals, as a target group, as well as partner in promoting development in partner countries. The diaspora has enormous potential for the development of origin countries, remittances, Bill Swing mentioned it this morning, that directly benefit families in need, the knowledge transfer to strengthen capacities in local institutions, etc. Coming back to the migration puzzle, the GFMD has identified a number of lessons learned of different pieces of the puzzle when it comes to the promoting diaspora engagement for development of countries of origin. First point, know your diaspora. It is indispensable to get to know the diaspora by conducting mapping and studies and include diaspora organizations and individuals in the development planning of origin countries. Talk to your diaspora. It is important that origin countries establish a dialogue with their diaspora in order to understand needs, constraints, and potentials. This is the basis to develop policies that promote diaspora engagement and then strengthen their capacities. It is important to train relevant stakeholders on how to make use of migration for development stakeholders dialogue, such as the civil society days in our GFMD model, or the common space. Examples, the German Federal Office for Migration and Refugees has supported selected migration organizations by means of capacity building trainings. This structural support aims at establishing migrant organizations that work in all parts of Germany as a steady and reliable point of contact for federal authorities. BAMF, this authority I mentioned, provides funding to help the organizations set up a secretariat and make their work more professional. Given that Germany recognizes the diaspora as an important development actor, the German Federal Ministry for Economic Cooperation and Development supports the active participation of diaspora representatives in global fora on migration and development. The GITS, the Deutsche Gesellschaft für internationale Zusammenarbeit, so the executing body for the Ministry of Development, prepares diaspora representatives through capacity development measures for the participating in, for instance, the UN High-Level Dialogue on International Migration and Development, as well as the yearly German Global Forum Migration and Development Civil Society Days. As the Global Forum on Migration and Development has also been highlighting the role of diaspora in private sector, German Development Cooperation also promotes this economic potential of the diaspora by supporting diaspora entrepreneurship in countries of origin. The most well-known and most direct contribution of diasporas are remittances. Bill Swing mentioned it this morning. Germany is the fifth largest sending country worldwide. More than $22 billion were sent from Germany in 2015. For many recipients, remittances are a survival strategy, primarily spent on basic needs, including healthcare and education, that can also promote growth and job creation and play an important role in the economies of many emerging and developing countries. On the other hand, you have to see the risks. As we learned, Eduard Kneser, my Swiss colleague and friend, and me, we were in Vienna last 2 days, and about 25% depend to more than 25 countries depend to more than 10% of those remittances. I was glad to hear that Ukraine is below this level, but this creates a certain dependency, as our Ethiopian partners had to learn now when they were ousted from the Gulf region. Nevertheless, Swing had it, only a little behind foreign direct investment, remittances are the largest source of finance and are more stable in times of crisis than most other capital flows. Bearing this poverty-reducing effects of remittances in mind, it is essential to reach Sustainable Development Goals 10.7 to reduce transaction costs of migrants' remittances to less than 3% and eliminate remittances corridors costs at higher than 5%. The prices are up to 10-12%. And once again, working with the figures of Bill Zwingli, we share this conviction of $500 billion, 5,000 million. Keep this in mind. If you reduce it, the costs by just 1%, you give the family of the poor $5 billion per year. Just by reducing the cost by 1%, and now they are up to 10-12%, we want to bring it down to 5, ideally to 3%. 1% less means 5 billion for the families. Example, the German price comparison portal, www.geldtransfer.de. If there's a report of this reunion, I can will gladly hand over the link. Shows current fees charged by money transfer companies and financial institutions, exchange rates, and the time the transfer takes, as a transparent way of informing and helping diaspora select cost-effective and quick and safe money transfer modes. Furthermore, remittances are often considered a first entry point for financial, both of senders and recipients, as they have the first contact with the formal financial system. In its report to the High-Level Political Forum in 2017, GFMD has highlighted the manifold linkages between migration and SDGs, both of explicit and implicit nature. As described in the previous minutes, the diaspora is an important actor and partner in promoting our partners' countries' development, and in order to solve migration puzzle, we need strong diaspora groups at the table of the international discourse on migration and development, and we need you. To put it in a nutshell, we have now 10 years of Global Forum on Migration and Development. We were preparing the ground. We discussed it with about 160 countries, I guess. So, and these are the same countries that are pushing now in New York after the New York resolution on refugees on the one hand and migrants on the other hand, the migration issue. And the aim, the objective is in September 2018, to have the migration, Global Migration Compact, and our Global Forum on Migration Development as the veteran on the battlefield, we are preparing now our reports. And after all, we want to have in August, September next year, maybe not a legally binding, but politically committing document. Politically committing means that the states will declare how they promote legal, orderly migration, how they combat trafficking, undecent working conditions, these reducing remittances, recruitment fees, Bill had it, of sometimes a year's salary. So, and in this context, that's where you come in. I hope, I implore you to push your governments to asking in the hours in the parliamentary question, what does your government do in favor of legal migration to combat undocumented labor, exploiting? What do you make to open up building schooling systems for young migrants to integrate them in the model? And I'm looking forward for today, this evening, the reception, and tomorrow for many bilateral meetings to discuss with you how we together can push your governments for this Global Migration Compact, and I hope we'll have a good exchange on these points. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. I would now like to turn to our next keynote speaker, who is Mr. Felipe de Botton from Portugal. He has a very long, impressive career in banking, finance, real estate, hospitality, manufacturing, and he is currently the president of the Portuguese Council of Diaspora.
Thank you, President. Thank you to everybody, the deputies, the politicians. I feel a little bit like a fish outside of the water, to be honest, in this assembly, because, to be honest with you, I mean, we created this council, which is called Conselho da Diáspora Portuguesa. It's a Portuguese organization that we set up in 2012. And it was totally a product of the civil society. So we decided back in 12 that we should bring together the Portuguese that were outside and from the Portuguese that were inside. We have roughly, Portugal is a small country. We have 10 million inhabitants, as most of you are aware of. But we have 5 million Portuguese living abroad. So we thought that bringing together those 15 million people could be something of interest, and certainly could be something that would bring together and could leverage on those people helping Portugal and vice versa. So when I was listening to the interesting presentations of my two colleagues before about the diaspora and bringing together the people that are outside the countries or inside the countries, which in fact is what we have been doing now for the last 4 years, I think it's extremely important for any country and certainly for Portugal in our case. Allow me in a nutshell to explain you how we work. We are not an example for anyone. We don't feel ourselves as being an example, but it works. And it works, and not only in words, because we feel, and since the very beginning, what we wanted from this council is to have something with practical attitudes and bringing some solutions to the topics and not just very nice words around what should be done. So we try to implement things that could bring together those people. We started in 2012. In fact, it was from 2004 to 2012, we've been holding what we were calling in Portugal a globalization council, where we'd invited once a year for a think tank 10 to 25 of the most prominent CEOs of the big international multinationals, the Ciscos, the Intels, the Googles, the Toyotas, the Castell, I mean, all the companies, Siemens, SAP, I mean, all companies from any country. And we bring those CEOs to come in to discuss a little bit with the Portuguese president and by that time with the president, Mr. Barroso, to discuss for a day what would be the trends and what would be happening for the following years. So as you can imagine, for instance, I remember in 2007 discussing the subprime with some of the most influent bankers, namely from Germany and from the UK, and they were very incisive in mentioning that the subprime was something very local that would only happen in the US and would certainly not spread to the rest of the world. I mean, so we saw how it happened and what happened after that. Back in 12, we thought it would be important to bring together, of those 5 million Portuguese living abroad, trying to spot, to map the 100, whatever it means, the 100 Portuguese living abroad, working for non-Portuguese organizations or non-Portuguese companies that would be ready to help. So I would say it's a kind of Portuguese of influence that would bring together, that would come together, and the four main pillars, so obviously economy and companies, business is a relevant one, but a country today it's much more than just business and just the economy. It's certainly arts, which was the second pillar, science, and citizenship. So those four pillars were the main pillars where we started mapping people, and today we are 95 councillors of this Conselho da Diáspora, working together on those five pillars, trying to implement something different for Portugal. We also thought that even being a product or something that were born out of the the civil society, we should have as honorary president our President of the Republic, but as Vice Honorary President, the Minister of Foreign Affairs. We thought it was important to bring together government and presidents and to avoid those small tensions that sometimes happen in politics between those two entities. And so we made that on a very Portuguese way, which is having everybody together in harmony and not trying to do something from one or from the other. So we started working back in 2012. And one was saying that with precise topics. For instance, we launched an initiative on cancer in order to prevent cancer in Portugal, to save around 2 billion euros per year in terms of new methodologies with the MD Anderson institution in US, in Houston, which is probably the largest cancer institution. We launched initiatives creating a biotechnology hub in Portugal through one of our counselors living in San Francisco that was in that area. We initiated and generated a new law in Portugal in order to allow the Portuguese companies and the government to get financed through Islamic bonds, through the sukuks. So we decided that we need to bring something different in terms of creating a forum to bring together Africa and Europe. So we have been launching, on the last 4 years, practical and truly initiatives where we thought it was important not only to bring together or to give some new image of Portugal, but certainly to bring together the diaspora, as we say, the ones from the outside to the inside and vice versa. But we thought we could not just stay with our generation or my generation, so certainly not getting only those people. And what we realized, like in many other countries, you have a lot of associations today of students. And so we started mapping, for instance, we have been mapping over 10,000 scientists, Portuguese scientists, that have been living abroad for many years. So we brought together all those associations, meaning that today the council will bring together around an influence of around 30,000 people who live abroad, but trying to bring them into, trying to having them dialoguing, trying to help and support the country. So that's what we've been doing in the past. Obviously, it is 100% funded by its own members, so we don't want to be funded by the government or by the community. We think those kind of institutions like the Conselho de Diaspora should be totally independent, and we should be able to create our own initiatives in corporations. We do work in full corporations, for instance, with the Portuguese diplomacy. We have counselors in the 45 cities. They all work in cooperation with the ambassadors in those places, because we think an ambassador, with all the respect, typically will stay in charge or in place for 3, 4, max 5 years, and typically 3, 4 years. He cannot have the same leverage, he cannot have the same knowledge, the intimacy with the society where he's living, if we compare with someone who's living there for less 30 or 40 years, have been successful in arts or in business or in science. He has much more capacity of trying to introduce the country into this society than, with all the respect, an ambassador. So that's why we need to work in full articulation with an ambassador. So that's what we're going to try to achieve. That is my testimony in terms of the Conselho de Diaspora, and thank you for hosting us here today. Thank you so much, and thank you for coming to Portugal.
And our final keynote speaker today is Dr. Jean-Christophe Dumont, and he has a PhD in development economics and is currently the head of the OECD International Migration Division in the Direction for Employment, Labor, and Social Affairs. In addition, he oversees the publication on migration called the International Migration Outlook, and he is indeed one of the most experienced specialists on migration in the world today.
Well, Excellencies, Member of Parliament, distinguished participants, it's an honor to be here today and to attend this launch. I understand I am the last speaker. You've heard quite a lot of data already. I have my speech full of additional data. I'll try to make that brief, also to give some time for the discussion. I mean, you've heard 240 million international migrants today in the world. What is important to keep in mind is that just 20 years ago there were 80 million less. So the number of migrants, even if a percentage remains almost stable over the years, the number of migrants is increasing quite rapidly. 115 million live in the OECD, almost 80 million live in European countries, not European Union, European countries. These migrants bring with them a large range of skills, and that's going to be the focus of my talk, constituting a major asset for economies and our companies in terms of host countries. But they also represent formidable potential for countries of origin. We've heard Ambassador Schmidt-Bremer just told us about the importance of remittances and what we need to do in this respect. But migrants, the contribution of migrants goes well beyond remittances. Migrants make a great source of human resources, skills, that is sometimes underestimated and most always underutilized. About a third of recently arrived migrants in the OECD, those who came in the past 5 years, I'm not talking about history here, I'm talking about today, have a tertiary diploma. About a third of migrants in the OECD, recent migrants, have a tertiary diploma. 40% of European migrants have a tertiary diploma. The contribution of a diaspora to the economic and social development of its host country or region of origin, because maybe we should also go beyond the fact that migrants will only contribute to their specific country. Maybe they want to contribute more broadly to their region of origin. Depends on many factors such as its size, average skill level, wealth, seniority, degree of organization. It also depends on prevailing condition in the country of origin. That also we should not forget. Migrants can make a huge contribution, but they need an enabling environment in terms of institution, in terms of safety in their country of origin. Government of both origin and destination country can facilitate, or sometimes hinder, the involvement of diaspora by supporting network, facilitating communication channels, creating enabling environment, as I just said, or more directly by easing skills, mobility. And that's, again, going to be my focus. However, in support of this objective, detailed knowledge about diaspora is crucial. It's been recalled one of the key recommendations by the GFMD, and I think this is a very important one. The lack of statistical information, we've heard a lot of figures, not always consistent between themselves. And also, we know maybe the numbers, but we don't know so well who these people are, what is their socioeconomic profile, for how long they have been out of a country, what is their family situation, do they have children, are they married, married with whom, with a national of your country, with someone from a different country. Basically, we have aggregated the numbers, but we have a serious lack of information about the exact profile and aspiration of this diaspora. As a contribution to close this knowledge gap, the OECD and the Agence Française de Développement, French Agency for Development Aid, work together to construct what is currently the most comprehensive source of information by country of origin on migrants in OECD countries and beyond, because actually we cover 100 country of destination. So we've also worked in coordination with the World Bank to collect this data. These data are presented in this publication that I have here. It's entitled Connecting with Immigrants, a Global Profile of a Diaspora. So the latest edition is 2015. I'll be very happy to send you electronic copies if you want one. And it contains 140 country notes, showing the size, the characteristics, the dynamic of migrant population by country of birth. And that's one of the limitations. We focus on country of birth and not on country of nationality. And I know that for some country, this is a big difference. But that's the best we can do so far. It also includes information on children of immigrants. So not the third or the fourth generation, as we've heard before, but the second generation. And we have information about labor market outcomes of your diaspora in destination country, country of destination by country of destination. And we've added also information on immigration intention for people in your country, how many would like to go, to which extent are they prepared, and to which country they would like to go, by skill level, by gender, by age. So I think that information can be useful for this network, and I'm very happy to share it individually or globally. So that you know, we also use at the OECD this data to do in-depth case study, and I don't know, this is This is just luck, but the first two were on Germany and Morocco ambassador. So maybe I should give them to you. but we now doing Romania. I know that there are some representatives from Romania. I'll be very happy to talk to them. We're looking at Tunisia, and we plan to do a series in West Africa. I think UK, France, and some other OECD countries would also be extremely interesting to look more in depth. So this new data confirms the emergence of new migration patterns, which prompt a revisit of a condition under which migrants and their descendants can contribute to the economic, social, and cultural development of their country of origin. Let me just highlight three main findings from this data. Data confirm a diversification of migration movements. Spain and Italy, for example, receive now as many migrants from Senegal or Morocco than France. Kenyan diaspora has been decreasing over the past 10 years in the UK, getting smaller and smaller. It has doubled in the meantime in the US. You see big changes in terms of countries of origin and countries of destination. Monitoring these changes in real time, not 5 years down the line, is crucial to design targeted policy to support and engage with diaspora. Data also confirm a rapid increase in highly skilled migration. In the past 10 years, the total number of tertiary educated migrants in the OECD, increased by 70%, 70. So huge increase, and the trend is continuing, if not accelerating. In total, we have 35 million migrants who hold a tertiary diploma in the OECD, 1 million with a PhD who were born abroad. Engaging with increasingly highly skilled diaspora, who can contribute a lot, but, and that you should keep in mind, also have alternative options and have very high opportunity cost, requires adapting to adapt the policies. Building trust, improving the information flow, reducing administrative barriers for them to engage will be only the necessary first step. It's also very important to engage with the private sector, and I think that the expense we've just heard from Portugal is very interesting in this respect. You say it's not the best practice example, but it certainly tends to look like it. Another silent fact that emerged from this data concerns the growing number of migrant women. We haven't discussed that, but more than one in two migrants in the world is a woman. Migrant women are initiating migration more and more, so meaning they're not reunificating with someone. They're just the first person to migrate and then maybe marry with someone from their country of origin, reunite. So, and actually, if you focus on recent flows, the proportion of skilled migrants is in fact higher among women than among men. So not only migration is more and more feminized, but migrant women are extremely highly qualified. And you can understand that from many respects in terms of the opportunities that migration provide to these highly skilled women, but also in terms of the selected demand in some destination country. Better understanding the specific expectation of migrant women regarding their engagement in promoting economic and social development in their country of origin, including through business creation, for example, would be extremely helpful to design diaspora policy. So this diaspora policy, in a way, should also be gendered. That's what I would suggest. Lastly, I would like to refer to the sharp rise in the number of native-born children of immigrants, of whom it has been estimated that there is a combined total number of over 50 million in the OECD alone. Obviously, it's a more significant phenomenon for some countries of origin, traditional long-standing countries of origin, notably in Europe and Africa, but this is a trend that is growing everywhere. And for all countries of origin. Many of his descendants have close ties with their parents' countries of birth and which to contribute. The dual nationality, the multilingualism, and the double culture as many assets to value and promote. This potential should not be neglected. although the aspiration of this group also needs to be clearly identified and the policy adapted in this regard. A policy to support diaspora need to keep pace with the change, but also need to get rid of a couple of preconceived ideas. I just want to raise four key principles, if I may, to end my presentation. Firstly, it's necessary to better apprehend the needs and the aspiration of a diaspora, because it's only in responding to these needs and aspirations that the policy you will put in place will enable to mobilize their full potential. This requires the establishment, as I said, in the case of Ali Skill, but I think this is more general, of a trust relationship and formal channel of dialogue. The question of the political representation and of the role of migrant association is very key in this regard. Secondly, it is important to make a clear distinction between policy who seek to support mobility, including through return, and those who are addressed to settle migrants in host country and who may still maintain links with a country of origin and want to contribute. For too long and far too often, the economic contribution of diaspora has been centered or even reduced to return migration and financial transfer. There are today many other ways to meet the links and enable this contribution. Again, as it was illustrated in the Portuguese context just a few minutes ago. And thirdly, it is important to recall that a successful economic and social integration in the destination country is a prerequisite for making a positive contribution back home. Those who are excluded or in a precarious situation in the labour market of your country do not have enough resources to share them. Integration in the host country and contribution to the country of origin are simply two sides of the exact same coin. This often requires a constructive dialogue between countries, between the country of origin and the country of destination, in order to make sure that diaspora migrants abroad have access to social rights, that issues around skills recognition are addressed, that access to education and training is available. That requires a constructive dialogue between countries. Fourth and lastly, it is advisable to maintain a balance between incentive and equity, so that the special condition that you offer for diaspora members in order to mobilize them are not seen by non-migrants as a form of favoritism, with the risk that it might create ever a push factor for further migration, because people feel that they're going to get this special condition only if they become migrants, or create a backlash in the country of origin against the contribution that migrants may bring. So this question of maintaining this balance between the incentive and the equity is also very important. I hope that these few figures and thoughts at the end will be useful for the work of this parliamentarian network, but be sure that the OECD will be very keen to contribute and participate to your work in the way you think is the most appropriate. Thank you very much for your listening.
Thank you, Dr. Dumont. I also want to thank all our keynote speakers for being very disciplined, and we have now returned to our schedule. We only have two people who have signed up for interventions, and so I would like to first call on Ms. Monkasa Bitumba, who represents a platform of Congolese women in Belgium.
Merci, Madame la Présidente.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are here addressing the contribution of diasporas to the development of countries of origin, and I would like within this context to share with you a couple of experiences that we've had. I think this is important because you can have individual contributions But you can also have contributions that are organized by small-scale groups, and I'd like to emphasize this second category. So as I spoke earlier, I talked about the experience of the Congolese female diaspora members in Belgium, and we have 11 of us, 11 women, visited various provinces in the Congo in groups of two, and we worked with Congolese parliamentarians as well as church workers and various categories or women. We helped them prepare elections, and this was a very constructive and enriching experience. They were able to see that we could contribute something to them, to our country of origin, because they have knowledge, they have expertise, but they sometimes lack the necessary know how to go to advance their work or to deepen their work. And so we can contribute in terms of providing such instruments. And these types of interventions or experiments, so we also have women who go to other countries in Africa, to Benin, to Mozambique, and who work with people there in order to help empower women. And these are very small-scale initiatives, but which provide a huge amount of value for these and the huge contribution of members of diaspora to their countries of origin. What I'd like to also emphasize here is to reflect on how to establish dialogue between the political officials, the political decision makers in countries of origin and country and host countries, because the contribution of these women from the diaspora to their countries of origin, in order for this contribution to be to have even more of an impact. What I'm trying to say is that these contributions are not always fully recognized, and they're not very often granted financial support. So very often these women pay out of pocket for these initiatives, and they pay for the they have studied quite extensively and have doctoral degrees and want to contribute. And so it would be useful to have mechanisms so as to ensure that there is proper dialogue between countries of origin and host countries, and so that their true value is actually given to these contributions by women, and including financial contributions, that is. Thank you.
Spoke too soon. We have a few more people who have signed up and would like to speak, so I'd like to ask everyone to please keep your remarks to about 2 minutes. The next person will be Mr. Bilhi, who represents a Turkish NGO in Germany.
Thank you, Your Excellencies, Members of Parliament, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to say also thank you to all those who organized this conference. It was important and required such a conference. Let me introduce myself, quick and short. I'm the Secretary General of the Union of European Turkish Democrats. We have nearly 150 offices across Europe, from north to south, from east to west. I would like to provide some thoughts. There are two important aspects, differences, which needs to be discussed in detail. The first one is the reason for migration. We had some reasons, like the Palestinian colleagues said before, the occupation, war, economic reasons, etc. And the other one is what to do and how to deal with those who are still in other countries. We need to divide there into parts, migrants and refugees. Please keep in mind, current refugees are future migrants. This is important. Today we are here mainly to discuss about the diaspora. We said in the morning, today in the morning, everyone in Europe and ideally everywhere, anywhere else should have the freedom to keep his culture, religion and traditions. But especially in Germany, as well as in Austria and some other countries, the politicians are speaking about Leitkultur. Nobody knows really what does it mean, Leitkultur in Germany as well. We had yesterday evening a TV show where the Ministry of Integration had another thought about Leitkultur as the other minister from the Bavaria. And there is no alignment regarding this. And I would say we in Europe, we do not need Leitkultur. We need a culture of acceptance. This is really important from my point of view. At last but not least, a short comment to Mr. Ashotyan, the Armenian Member of Parliament. He spoke about the recommendation of Mr. Erdogan in terms of German elections to the German Turks in Germany. When he criticizes Erdogan, he should also criticize the German government for the comments and actions during the referendum in terms of constitutional change. You know, there are some TV spots in the TV in German, on the German broadcast. There were information about how bad the new constitution is. It is the same, so please be fair and say it at the same time to this area as well. So we can speak a lot of such things in Germany. And if there is a need, I can give a briefing to Mr. Ashotyan as well. It's a pleasure for me. So at the end, I would like to say I hope for follow-up of this type of conferences. And thank you.
Okay, thank you. And now we have three members of Parliament who would like to speak, so I'd ask you, so that we get to dinner on time, that you speak for about 2 minutes each. Mr. Couscous from Morocco.
Shukran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I'd like to thank the speakers for excellent contributions. I would like, if possible, to go back and to react to Mr. Eduardo Cabrita's presentation. He, in his presentation, provided a number of figures and statistics and the various initiatives undertaken by the government of Portugal to help migrants settle here. I can only welcome such a systematic approach, but this cannot necessarily be generalized, and it would not make sense, in fact, to generalize such an approach everywhere. Unfortunately, there are a number of host countries in which there's a rise in xenophobia and very nationalistic and discourses inciting racism and xenophobia, and so as national parliaments, as governmental bodies from countries of origin as well as countries host countries, we need to work with the diasporas, because diasporas are particular categories within our societies who have their own aspirations, their own needs, but we also need to adapt our constitutions in order to safeguard the rights of these communities, the rights to multiple cultures, amongst other rights. And also we need to look at diaspora communities as bridges, as links between different cultures and societies, and we can leverage these communities to build more tolerance coexistence and joint living between different civilizations. So another point that I was surprised not to hear during our whole discussions today, that is to say the role of the media, the potential role of the media in promoting political as well as cultural plurality within host societies. This is a very important point. I think this, for instance, could focus on the efforts made by these communities in these societies, their contributions to successful social or political experiments, and not only focus exclusively on the negative aspects of these or negative portrayals of these communities. I do have also another of other points, contributions in terms of fostering the participation of diasporas in their countries of origin. We all know that many of these migrants contribute, and we know in our minds that they contribute to the development of their countries of origin, and that in fact their migration will have a positive impact on their countries of origin's economies through remittances, as many of you have mentioned, or through investments in their countries of origin as well. However, we should also note that this contribution and I'd like to say this from the perspective of a country of origin in Africa, we, of course, this contribution cannot necessarily meet expectations, especially in countries in North Africa, for a number of different considerations. So one of these considerations would be the lack or complete absence of a multiplying effect on social and economic and the social and economic fields. And so a lot of these contributions simply go towards improving the living conditions of families back home. And also the cost of these remittances, as we said, was very high. And so this is a further obstacle. Thank you.
And now we have two members of parliament from Egypt. Please, Mr. Mustafa.
I'd like to thank the Parliamentary Assembly and the Parliament of Portugal. I'll be very brief. My colleague addressed many of the different points I wanted to make. I wanted simply to highlight another point, that is to say that Egypt has more than 100,000 issues. We face a very severe economic crisis, and we're trying to grow, to boost our economy. But despite this, there's more than a million Syrian brothers. I will describe them as brothers. They're not refugees. They are brothers and sisters to us. There are thousands of Iraqis and Libyans as well. And so a number of ministerial decisions and orders have been issued to ensure that all of these migrants have access to education, much like Egyptians. And so and they live amongst the population as well. They don't live in secluded centers, so they live with us. They invest, they work in the private sector, and they have a full freedom to work in the private sector as well as to transfer their money, their funds. So this is the point that I wanted to add. That is to say that our country is home to many, many brothers and sisters from other countries, and expecting the situation to improve in their countries. Thank you.
Mr. Talat.
Thank you.
Excellency, Madam Chair, I'll be very brief. I simply an important point. The political interests that may vary between countries of origin and host countries, and that this is a price that's paid by the diasporas. We need to find resolution to conflicts or to tensions between these countries, because that can only be beneficial. And so we've seen whenever there's a terrorist attack, there are unfair reactions against migrants, generally speaking, and this they cannot be held responsible for this. But also, as Egyptians, we are faced with many different attacks, in fact organized killings, for instance in Libya, of Egyptian workers, and so some 23 Egyptian workers were gunned down in Libya. So I think that it's important for each state in which such crimes are committed to pay compensation to these people whose rights were violated. And there's also illegal migration. As the Egyptian parliament, we have adopted a law criminalizing all participants in these networks, in these trafficking networks. But we need also to help countries of origin. We in Egypt have an unemployment rate of 13%. And if you do not have genuine economic growth in countries of origin, we're not going to be able to find solutions to illegal migration. We have an investment policy and targeted as well at reducing illegal migration. And all experts in the field know that if you invest in countries of origin of illegal migration, you are already addressing a root cause. Thank you.
Thank you. I think this has been a very thought-provoking, interesting day. And now we can continue our discussions, our debates, and our thoughts over dinner. I would like to say to everyone, thank you again. Our buses are waiting for us. They will take you to the hotel. And after you have a little bit of time to maybe change, they will take you again to a restaurant for dinner. I look forward to seeing you at dinner.
يعني اروح الفندق ونرجع بقى كده ايه يعني احنا